Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It is a strange thing that when a rape is reported and evidence collected, that the rapist can go free for years simply because law enforcement often do not bother to follow up on the evidence. Rapists can go on to assault many more women before they are caught, if ever. They can even have the statute of limitations on their crimes expire just because no one got around to processing the evidence against them. Imagine if murderers or other criminals got the same treatment. In recent years, the huge backlog of so-called rape kits in cities around the country has proven to be embarrassing enough that there is now some action. While Los Angeles and New York have cleared their rape kit backlogs, many cities remain behind. One of my guests, Abigail Tracy, reports that Memphis is currently testing its way through 12,347 kits. Detroit found 11,341 unprocessed kits in a storage facility in 2009. Houston and Las Vegas are tackling backlogs of 6,663 and 4,385 rape kits, respectively. And there are dozens of other cities with counts in the hundreds and thousands, and many more that don't even know if they are sitting on massive piles of untested evidence. Joining me now is not only Abigail Tracy, who I just quoted, she's a reporter for Vocative, but also Natasha Alexenko, founder of the Natasha Justice Project. Welcome to Uprising, Natasha and Abigail.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Natasha, I'd like to start with you. Can you give our audience a sense of what the Natasha Justice Project is? How did this project come about in the first place? Natasha? We're going to, okay, well, we do have Abigail with us, so we'll turn to Natasha in just a few minutes. So, Abigail, you wrote a piece in Vocative entitled Rape Kit Backlog Grows Nationwide, Jeopardizing Prosecutions. Why don't you explain for us why there is such a huge backlog to begin with? Is there a comparable crime, for example, for which evidence is treated the same way as rape kits are?
So I think there are a lot of reasons why the backlog exists today. Two of them, one of the big things today is that DNA testing has become much more standard in police investigations and technology has improved. So today, you know, we have certain technologies and crime labs throughout the country are outfitted with the ability to actually test these kits, but that wasn't so much so the case in the early 90s or 2000s. Also, a big difference has been sort of I think for a long time, sexual assault went misunderstood, and I think investigators didn't necessarily understand the serial nature of the crime to the right extent. You know, you look at these perpetrators, and in many cases, they are serial, so they've committed not just, you know, other sexual assaults, but many of them also have other violent crimes to their name. But I think that went misunderstood for a long time, and that's sort of kind of what everybody who I've sort of spoken with about this issue, Natasha included, have pointed to. So I think there's a combination of technology catching up and a misunderstanding of the nature of the crime. And also, I think what we have today is to clear these backlogs, it'll require a lot of manpower and it'll require money. And I think right now, those are sort of some of the obstacles that have to be tackled to kind of clear these backlogs. In terms of other crimes with similar things, I am not certain that there's at all kind of this similar backlog of evidence that has been untested as with rape kits. And I think that does go back to the crime itself and the DNA testing. I think you obviously will have some evidence because of, you know, the DNA testing rules still hold with other DNA evidence. But I think there are just a myriad of reasons why this backlog exists.
We do have Natasha Alexenko with us. Natasha, can you tell us about the Natasha Justice Project? How did it come about?
Well, certainly. I'm a survivor of sexual assault, and I'm a survivor of the backlog as well. My kit sat in a county storage facility in Manhattan collecting dust for 9.5 years. During the time my kit wasn't tested, the man that raped, sodomized, and robbed me was essentially on a nationwide crime spree. He was a one-man crime wave, and as was so eloquently mentioned earlier, you know, he didn't just rape, he property crimes, just a range of crimes. So he didn't just victimize other women, he victimized men and children as well. You know, finally my kit was tested, Victor Ronan was eventually apprehended, and I got the closure that was so difficult to achieve for so many years. And I was really inspired by the prosecutors and law enforcement in my case. I know my kit sat for 9.5 years, but once the administration changed and they recognized the value of the 17,000 kits that were sitting on shelves in New York City, they really turned things around quite quickly. So I was really inspired by them, and I really didn't want to be the anomaly, especially when I found out that throughout the nation there's hundreds of thousands of kits collecting dust. And, you know, every rape kit essentially represents a human being whose body was a crime scene.
Wow. So, I mean, 9.5 years, that's 9.5 years worth of other victims whose victimization could have been possibly prevented had your rape kit been processed and this perpetrator brought to justice. That just means that, I mean, that's just a huge failure, even if it is, you know, something that that represents a past failure, it has been a huge failure of the justice system. So Abigail, let's talk about the fact that the excuse being given, even now for some cities, is that just isn't enough funding to process these rape kits. Imagine if these were crimes against men.
So I think,
or mostly men. I mean, there must be some men among these.
Mm-hmm. I think when you look at the costs involved, they definitely exist. You know, I have spoken with people, and estimates to test an individual rape kit range from about $1,000 to $1,200, sometimes an upwards of $1,500 to test an individual rape kit. But so that's sort of the initial cost. You know, that's the cost of testing these kits. But that's really sort of the first step in these cases. And I think the costs down the line are also a factor. That's sort of what I've heard from law enforcement, is that, you know, maybe you do spend this $1,200 to test this kit. If you find a DNA profile from them, you incur many other costs down the road. Once you sort of reopen these cases, you have to reinvestigate everything kind of from start to finish and see the narrative. So that is the cost. But I think another issue is the manpower that these require. And I think you look at funding and you look at manpower, and like those are the two real obstacles. And municipalities, they need these because the backlog should be cleared. And I think the resources need to be available, whether that's funding and whether that's people, to kind of prosecute and go through all these cases. But those are the main two challenges that people point to for the reason that we haven't been able to clear the backlog nationwide.
Now, Natasha, what about the political sort of pressure that's been growing to try to address this? What sort of movement have you seen from congressional advocates to address the national rape kit backlog?
Well, certainly, I'm actually in D.C. At the moment. There was just a hearing on Capitol Hill. It's wonderful to see lawmakers and legislators come forward, put forth legislation, and that sort of thing. Unfortunately, it seems to be the same players over and over again. And, you know, I admire them for their dedication and tenacity. But unfortunately, it's not, you know, it's not across the board. I will say the positive thing is it's really a bipartisan issue, because it shouldn't have anything to do with either political party. It's a public safety issue. It's a public health issue. Everyone should be on board. But I really feel like where we're getting the most traction right now is state-by-state initiatives. You know, the federal government can only do so much to force a state into doing something specific. So we're seeing really some innovation on state levels in terms of putting legislations forward, specifically around counting, because, you know, we always talk about how many rape kits there are across the nation. We don't know. So many states, and I'm certainly a big advocate for this, are putting forth measures to say, okay, you have to let us know how many kits you have backlogged, how many kits you have unprocessed, sitting in police storage facilities, sitting in county storage facility. What does that number look like? And I think once we can, you know, kind of quantify what that number is, I think we're going to get the general public at large to be like, oh my goodness, we've got to do something about it. And then support for further legislation, I think, will be the next step.
I want to turn back to Abigail on the issue of the message that law enforcement has been sending to rapists when they, you know, didn't process these rape kits. How have things changed now? Now that technology is better available, what happens to a rape victim's rape kit when after they're raped, if they go in and get evidence collected, does it still go and sit on a shelf catching dust for years?
So I think, and I touched on this a little bit earlier, today you aren't going to see the same treatment of sexual assault victims as you did then. And these kits, because DNA is expected before any jury today, what you really see is that it is much more standard today than it was, you know, 10, 20 years ago. So what you see is, you know, there's also been a change in dialogue about the crime of sexual assault. I think so much more progress still needs to be made, but I think understanding the serial nature of these offenders and the people that commit these crimes has been major in terms of people sort of understanding when these new rape kits come in, the importance of testing them as a way to, you know, bring this person to justice who assailed these people throughout, you know. So I think what you're kind of seeing is the understanding has changed. So today you're not necessarily going to see rape kits sit on shelves, but the important thing is that if we clear the backlog, we might prevent some of those new rape kits coming in. And like that's sort of the cause and the importance of clearing the backlog.
And I want to talk about the larger sort of national conversations around sexual assault as they've changed, some progress that might be that we might be seeing, but also so much work that still needs to be done, because it seems as though every other day there's a national debate and dialogue on rape. Every other day there are also you know, members of Congress saying the stupidest and most callous things, some of which we'll get to. But one of the latest things is the HBO show Game of Thrones, which once more has come under fire. And, you know, pop culture is important in the way in which it influences people. And Natasha, I'm wondering what you make of the fact that yet again the sort of showing of gratuitous rape scenes in this very popular show is coming under fire, so much so that even Senator Claire McCaskill said she was, quote, done with the show. And of course it has its defenders saying, if you don't like it, don't watch it, and, you know, it's fiction after all. How do you respond?
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned this, because really Game of Thrones and this whole dialogue forced me to like create a blog of my own, because whereas it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the backlog, it does, because at the end of the day, the backlog is a symptom of a bigger disease. And I think, to me, with the Game of Thrones episode, and I have to say, I have not watched an episode this season, so I can't comment on that episode because I didn't watch it, but I've read all the articles, spoken with survivors, and, you know, I do read the comments, and one of the most, and this is just really, really good for your listeners to understand, because this is the kind of comments you get. For those of you who watched the show, it was, and spoilers ahead, but a character was raped violently by her husband on her wedding night. And a lot of the comments in the comment sections that were quite prevalent was, well, it wasn't really a rape because she was married and she knew what she was getting into. I mean, you know that your wedding night, you're going to have sex. So it wasn't a rape, it was consensual. So every time we have something in pop culture like this, it's really interesting to see where people's mentalities are. And, you know, you could look at it in a positive way and say, well, you just need to be educated, or you could take it in a more negative perspective. But my goodness, I mean, something like this, bringing up sexual assault, but it's always interesting to me that it has to be like, why does it have to be a TV show or a celebrity for us to have a dialogue about sexual assault?
Right.
You know, that's really upsetting to me. Like, we don't talk about it unless Bill Cosby's involved, or it's a television show, or a very popular university that has a sports team, or again, a national sports organization. Like, that should not be the dialogue, because you know what? Sexual assault affects everyone. You know, again, the man that raped me was creating male and female victims, not just around sexual assault. So, like, for us to just kind of, it's a woman thing, or whatever the case may be, or it doesn't really affect me, it is really a very, very dangerous perspective to have.
Absolutely. But, I mean, I do have to say that you brought up Bill Cosby, and when we talk about the issue of the serial rapist, this is, you know, a perfect example and giving people a good glimpse at what other rapists might be. Of course, he hasn't been tried in court, but if you don't ignore the 40 women now that have come forward and accused him of raping and assaulting them, which is a very difficult thing for any woman to come forward and do, but 40 of them have done it. He just seems quite incredulous about the issue. It really points to this sort of serial nature of this type of crime that often happens. I want to bring up a study that was just published on U.S. College campuses. And Abigail, I'd like to ask you a little bit about this as well. On May 20th, the Journal of Adolescent Health surveyed 480 women freshmen at a university in upstate New York and confirmed what other studies have found, that fully 20% of women on college campuses are sexually assaulted. And this points to what Natasha was just saying, that this is, you know, ordinary women every day facing rape. What do you make of this horrific statistic? That's 1 in 5 women on a college campus is likely to be sexually assaulted.
Well, I think that, you know, and there has been so much coverage of sexual assault on college campuses lately, and that statistic is staggering, but I absolutely, when I sort of hear that, it's not something that I question the validity of.
Of course.
I absolutely believe that that's a very accurate statistic. But I think one of the interesting things, and I think, you know, studies like this are very great, you know, they draw attention to the issue at hand, because what needs to happen on college campuses is, well, for starters, victims need to feel comfortable at their university to come forward. Because if they don't, and the administration or people aren't aware of it, that's a problem to begin with. But the most important thing is that these administrations respond to them. Because what will happen is, and it kind of goes back to the serial nature, it's, you know, say you sexually assaulted somebody and you learn that you were reported and nothing happened, what is the message that you're receiving in that situation? You are basically being told, that's okay, there are no repercussions for this, and it, you know, builds upon that, where you see other people who you're in classes with, or you were at a party with, and you see them treated the same way. If there aren't repercussions for these actions, people will think that in this environment, which, you know, especially I think one of the statistics in the study really focuses on college freshmen. So you're new, it's a new environment, there's a lot of drinking, things like that. So there are all these risk factors involved. But I think it's really important to punish people or show that these will be investigated, to send a message to not just that person or that assailant, but to everybody else in the community at that university, so
right,
you don't see these crimes continue to build.
Yes, and one of the women who has drawn a lot of attention single-handedly to the epidemic of campus rape is the Columbia student Emma Sulkowitz, who carried a mattress all over campus to publicize her rape by a fellow student. She just graduated, and the young woman garnered international attention when she started this project as her senior thesis, and the university apparently didn't address what happened to her. She finally did walk across the stage to receive her diploma recently, with several students helping her helping to carry the mattress with her that she'd been carrying around. And Columbia University President Lee Bollinger just ignored her and even refused to shake her hand like he shook everyone else's hand. And Natasha, I'm wondering how important it is for women like for other women to see Emma Sulkowitz's very important action as a way for, you know, as a message to that sends to them that maybe they aren't alone in experiencing what they experienced.
You know, I think Emma's just brilliant, and she's amazing and brave. And I think really it's important. I mean, things change, and we have to understand that someone who is a survivor 30 years ago has a different way of communicating their story. And I think that the way the college students are using their creativity, not taking no for an answer in terms of having their story put out there, is amazing. And that's the thing. So it goes viral, and you know, you have that message, and other survivors of sexual assault can feel they're not alone. And I think that that's such an important thing. I cannot tell you how many survivors I've heard from that are inspired by women like Emma, have decided to come
forward. And like yourself, I'm sure, Natasha. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and that's really what it's about. It's about sending a message to say you're not alone, and that, you know, I always say this, it's not always easy to come out as a survivor of sexual assault, but I'll tell you, it's not something I ever regret doing as coming publicly and talking about, but it's scary. I mean, because of all the things that we've been talking about, this perception that you're lying, or maybe you're flawed somehow, or that there was something you did to cause the situation. And you know what? We don't put enough onus on the person that committed the crime. And the reality is, the more of us that come forward as survivors, or the media supporting us, I think the more likely it's going to be that we're going to come out and make it safer for everyone.
Well, Abigail, speaking of media coverage, the University of Virginia story is a really interesting one. But what I want to ask you is not about the details of that case. This was basically a Rolling Stone magazine reporting a brutal gang rape on the campus of University of Virginia, details of which were later found to be questionable. The magazine retracted the story. Now the magazine is being sued by an administrator on the campus who says the article defamed her. But has this whole incident had a chilling effect on journalism, on sexual assault, and on reporting of sexual assault?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you look at the Rolling Stone article, it's an absolute shame that the opportunity to tell these stories and like highlight the fact that, you know, the severe nature and like the problem of sexual assault on campuses was lost due to poor journalism, which is essentially what the Columbia School of Journalism did say when they reviewed the article and kind of the story that they came out with. And as a journalist, like, you sort of look at what happened with that story and you see the holes from the beginning and you see the failings, and they basically kind of did exactly what they shouldn't have, because the sad thing is, the message that they were trying to send and the issue that they were trying to highlight was the right one. Like, this is a problem. There are rapes on campus and they need to be addressed and they need to be brought forth so people understand the crimes and everybody can come together to work toward fixing them. And the sad thing is that in this case, it was a fabricated story. The reporting ended up having massive holes in it, and it was invalidated by poor journalism, which is sad because there are so many true, accurate stories of sexual assaults on college campuses, and it's a shame that the opportunity to tell one of those stories was butchered by people not following the steps that they should have. So you have something like this, and that story went viral, it was on the national stage, and people sort of started having a conversation about it. And then when the story ended up not being accurate and embellished, what happened is the conversation changed.
Yeah.
And the conversation should have been about the issue of sexual assault, not the fact that this story was fabricated.
Well, finally, Natasha, what do you hope needs to happen now? And also, you know, on this program, one of the things we like to do is give our audience a sense of being able to participate in social issues of social justice. What can ordinary people do in terms of, you know, either lobbying their members of Congress, or, as you said earlier, in really lobbying state officials in the states where they live, where these rape kit backlogs exist, and also just changing the conversation and the culture around treating sexual assault?
Absolutely. I think, you know, with this cause is going to be solved by the people, by the general public. We're going to end the backlog because of the tenacity of the citizens. It's not going to happen because a politician has signed a bill or because some lab is testing kits. It's a philosophical issue, and that's why I think it's so important for every person to understand what is involved in testing the rape kits, why there's a backlog, and really about sexual assault in general, you know, and the misconceptions around it. I think good people it's really hard to believe, but I'll tell you, I mean, I had a great experience with police officers, but so many of my fellow survivors have said they didn't test my kit because they said, oh, you're probably lying, I don't believe you, or they're never going to prosecute this, or do you know who this guy is that you're accusing? I mean, literally, this is real, not just in a movie. This is what's going on. And the reality is, according to an FBI study, only 1% of women lie about their sexual assaults. I mean, think about what it's like to go through a rape kit exam, a four-hour-long, arduous process, where your body is crime scene, you're pulling pubic hair. I mean, to go through that, you know, there's very few people. Unfortunately, there's one, like you mentioned earlier, that's center stage, but very few people, you know, go to that trouble to make things up. So I think it's important to educate, you know, I guess the choir, if you will,
right.
So we can kind of go out and communicate that. But yes, very much in your state, find out who's fighting. Is there a politician that has a legislation forward? And then take it from there. Support that politician, if, you know, that sort of thing. It's so important.
I want to thank the two of you so much for spending this time with us and joining us today and shedding light on this very important issue. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
My guests, Natasha Alexenko, is founder of the Natasha Justice Project. Abigail Tracy, a reporter for Vocative. She recently wrote an article entitled Rape Kit Backlog Grows Nationwide, Jeopardizing Prosecutions. This is Uprising.